Good evening. I'm K2, Romeo, India, Whiskey. Along with Mel, K2, K-E-Y, we run a thing called the TechNet. And the TechNet is a gathering of amateur radio operators who help each other. We teach each other how to make things work, how to make them work better, how to get a little more enjoyment out of each one of the 26 different kinds of ham radio. There's more than one kind, as you can tell. A person signs into the technical net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. A typical sign-in would sound like this, W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe, and yes. And we may be hearing from Joe tonight because we didn't really answer his question correctly last week. So please give me your call letters and name at this time, K2RIW in the TechNet.
W-A-2-R-Y-Y, Joe, yes.
W-O-2-N, Bernie, yes.
So far we've got Joe and Bernie. Anyone else?
KC2, Tango Uniform X-Ray, yes.
And Mr. Tango Uniform X-Ray, what is your name, sir?
Sorry about that, Dick. Bill.
Okay, Bill, you're third on the list. Hope it doesn't take too long to get to you. Anyone else?
Good evening, all cases, A-E-Y.
And that was Mel. And one last call. Anyone else to check in? Give me your call letter's name and say yes if you've got a question or a comment.
Check in, Dick, and 2EO, no questions.
Okay, we've heard from Whitestone tonight.
WC2C, Aaron, in Sheepshead Bay. No questions. Good evening.
Okay, Aaron. Okay, Joe, last week there was a lot of misunderstanding that took place with reference to the sensitivity measurement on your repeater. Before I correct some of the errors we made last week, maybe you tell us if you've made any additional measurements and anything else you've discovered up till now. W-H-U-R-Y-Y, K-2-R-I-W on the TechNet.
Well, since this might be a complicated subject, I'll tell you what. How many other check-ins did you have after me? About three or four that I think I heard?
Only two after you.
Okay, well, ask the other two people if they have complicated questions or rather easy questions. And if they have easy questions, they can jump ahead and you can put me after those guys. I just checked in to make sure I checked in, okay? How's that sound? That's being a nice guy.
Fantastic. Okay. Bernie and then Bill. Bernie, do you think you've got a quick one? And I'll be asking the same thing to Bill. Bernie, W-O-2-N. Your question, the nature of it, K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, Dick, good evening, and good evening to the group. It's fairly, I would say, on a basic side. It should go quick. It's just an update on about a month, maybe 6 weeks ago, I called in about a wall dimmer switch. And the consensus at the time was that the switch I put in was defective, where it at half brilliance, I was getting a flickering to like full brilliance. Do you remember the conversation?
I sure do, Bernie. And the conclusion I thought we came to at the time was that either the switch you put in, the dimmer network you put in, was being improperly used. In other words, maybe you were using it at the 600 watt level and it's only good for the 300 watt level. Second of all, when you're at half brilliance, not full brilliance or not half or not all the way off, that's usually the roughest condition where it generates the most amount of heat. And the flickering, we came to the conclusion, was a heating phenomenon of a mechanism that was being overused, if you know what I mean. That was our guess, that the manufacturer may have been optimistic in his ratings, and either you're going to have to use less light bulb wattage or go to a bigger, dimmer network. And one of the reasons why half brilliance is the worst-case condition is not only is the greatest voltage drop taking place across the dimmer itself, and it's firing with 50% duty cycle, which is a pretty high heating condition, but also the light bulbs themselves, if they're incandescent bulbs, change by 10 to 1 in resistance of being full brilliance versus cold. So when they're at half brilliance, they're at a much smaller resistance, drawing more current, and therefore the total wattage that really the dimmer was being subjected to is a heck of a lot higher than first meets the eye. So these are some of our conclusions. Let's hope that you were able to buy a bigger one and make some kind of a change, and hopefully it got better. We'll soon find out. WO2N, K2RIW, you got it, Bernie.
WO2N, yep, exactly. That was the scenario. And interesting that it is under quite a bit of duty strain there at that demand. But I was drawing like 480 watts on a switch that was rated for 660. And what happened was I did send the switch back to the manufacturer, and I have a letter. He wrote me back that they didn't just merely send me a replacement switch, but they did test it in the lab, the device, for extended period of time. And they didn't find a problem with it. Then they disassembled it, checked all the components. There was no marks of arcing, no voids on the potentiometer. All the brush contacts are within spec, et cetera, et cetera. The bottom line is he suspects I have a problem with my lighting here. They did give me an updated switch, same rating. I have no problem with it running it about 2 weeks now. And it doesn't fail. The only thing I was thinking on my end here, which we didn't discuss, and this is the question tonight. One of the original demos I had had two black wires, two blacks, and they say to connect the load to the black wire. Well, there's two blacks. So, is it possible that I was wiring it to the neutral, putting a line on the neutral of the switch? In other words, if you feed the potentiometer through the resistor, and then the wiper picks up, and then it goes to the fixture. Now, if you feed it backwards, is that a scenario? I mean, I could put an old switch back in there, wire it backwards, and see if I get that effect of flashing and have brilliance problems. I didn't do the answer test. All I know it's working now, and I'm leaving it. But the only thing I think I could have done here was possibly wire it backwards, where I fed it into the wiper instead of the resistor, if that would make a problem. Dick?
I wouldn't say that's impossible, Bernie, but I think it's unlikely. You can find out real fast why there are two black wires. It may be just something for the convenience of the way you usually wire a breakout box. I think there's a medium-high probability that when you check with your ohmmeter, you'll find that the two black wires are wired to almost the same spot internally. You may find 0 ohms of resistance between the two black wires. And feeding a dimmer backwards, I don't think it would work correctly if you fed it backwards. No, I don't think you fed it backwards. When they tested it in the laboratory, the one that you thought was defective, the possibility exists that they used a dummy load in the laboratory, which was a pure resistor. If they used a dummy load in the laboratory that was a pure resistor, which is very different than a set of your particular brand of light bulbs, they would get a false positive that everything's hunky-dory. So there's more details going on here. It turns out that incandescent light bulbs fed at half brilliance are a very severe load. 600 watts worth of light bulbs will be a 600 watt load with the full 120 volts AC going to it. With only, let's say, 60 volts going to it, it'll act more like not a 600 watt light bulb, it'll act more like a 1500 watt light bulb string, if you know what I mean. Because the way the resistance goes down from the red half brilliance. You can prove this to yourself by taking any incandescent light bulb you own. Put your ohm meter across the contacts and measure the number of ohms. And with the simple formula of I squared over R, E squared R, or whatever, you can calculate with 120 volts applied to that resistor how many watts would the light bulb draw. And you'll come to a conclusion that it draws roughly 10 times. In other words, a 100 watt light bulb, when it's cold, acts like more than a 1,000 watt load. So, incandescents are really nasty, and that lab test they did may have been a pure resistor. So, sounds to me like you've got a partial solution for the time being. Maybe they gave you a replacement. Maybe the unit they gave you needed a better heat sink. Maybe you put one less light bulb in the circuit so it's not as heavy a load. I think you said you're not getting the flickering now. But it'll be an eye-opener to you when you do the ohmmeter test on an ordinary incandescent bulb.
Repeater, timeout.
It'll be an eye-opener when you do an ordinary ohmmeter test on an incandescent bulb when it's cold and do a calculation as to how many watts. And when you put your ohmmeter on those two black leads, if you get a chance to do it, I think you're going to find out they're the exact same spot, Bernie. W-O-2-N, K2-R-A-W in the TechNet.
K2-K-E-Y would comment on it.
Yeah, go ahead, Mel.
Okay, number one, when we discussed it the last time, I think he said he had it in a plastic receptacle box. They may have tested it open on a bench, and if he has a thermal runaway situation there, what'll happen is, of course, on the open bench, it may work better. Or if he mounted it into a metal box, the part of that frame that of this thing, you know, where it mounts, is part of the heat sink, because I've had a few of them apart. As far as the two black wires, it don't make a difference, because it is not a potentiometer that the potentiometer is controlling the FCR in there, or the triac in there, I should say. No, I said it's a triac. It's controlling the triac. So it don't make really a difference which black wire you use, Dick. I could say I've had them apart. But the difference in incandescent bulbs, if you have like candelabra type 110 volt ones, and compare them to, for some reason, if you try like 60 watt candelabra bulb as compared to a regular other bulb, there is a difference in resistance. I discussed this with people, you know, when they say using a light bulb, 110 volt light bulb, as a dummy load in a rig, you know, to test the rig, and I was explaining to them the difference between bulbs and also the difference in the resistance from cold to hot stick. So a lot more to it than that. But a lot of times it's you hook one of them up and put one of those dimmers in a plastic recessed box. You can't run them as to the amount of wattage as you would in a metal box, Dick, over.
Yeah, that's a very strong point. If you actually figure out the heat flow from the triac itself that's generating the heat, and it's got to dump the heat somewhere. It really needs a heat sink, but it's also got to be insulated from things that are grounded. If it had a short path, either by close proximity or really being mounted to the side of a metal breakout box, no problem, it's being well heat sunk. But if it's floating in air inside of a blue plastic breakout box, which gives very poor heat sinking, in other words, the air inside that blue breakout box can get hot as all hell, and the outside of the box can stay cold because the thickness of the blue plastic is a pretty darn good insulator. So these are some of the aggravating factors. So as you can see, Bernie, by the way, on a quick break, Mel, a candelabra bulb, 60 watt bulb versus an ordinary 60 watt incandescent light bulb, which one has a smaller cold resistance from your experiments, Mel? Go ahead.
Candelabra bulb. Draws a heck of a difference. The regular, if you take a regular, like, 100 watts incandescent bulb, you know, standard screw and bulb that we're all familiar with, when they, if you want to use it, for instance, dummy load, you've got to put a capacitor in there, a variable capacitor, 2.5 amp reactant, because you are getting approximately, around 4-to-1 SWR with it, believe it or not. It runs around, I think when I measured it, it was around 200 some odd ohms, Dick, when it's up to about full brilliance, over.
Yeah, in theory, a 120 watt light bulb, if there is such a number, with 120 watts going to it, 120 volts going to it, RMS, should draw exactly 1 ampere. So a 120 watt light bulb, in theory, would be exactly 120 ohms. A 100 watt light bulb is probably something like 150 ohms when it's at full brilliance. But you take a 100 watt light bulb when it's cold, you won't measure 150 ohms. You'll measure something like 15 or 10 ohms, some extremely small number. When that tungsten filament is cold, it changes a whole lot. And so And you're looking for a 50-ohm load. So a pair of 100-watt light bulbs in parallel at full brilliance comes close to 50 ohms. In the old days, this wasn't a problem because we all had a very large tuning range to our Pi output tuning network of our transmitters, our tube-type transmitters. Before they became compact, you had a real tuning control and a loading control capacitor, and they could tolerate almost anything. You now need some kind of an antenna tuner, as Mel was mentioning, when you're doing a 100-watt type test. So, let's turn it back to Bernie. Was it a blue plastic breakout box that you were putting this into, therefore very poor heat sinking, and that probably aggravated the problem? Did they give you a new one? Have you installed the new one? Is it working better? I think you said it was. W02N, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, okay, Dick, fine. Business. Yeah, and it was in the blue box, the one where it would absolutely make more heat, generate heat in there, wouldn't dissipate it. But when I returned the switch, I explained that was the conditions I had it. I had it in a blue box and suggested maybe the metal box would be more conducive for the type of switch that's mounted to the metal box can dissipate the heat. He didn't go there. He just said that, like I read before, they tested it at the lab and they were satisfied that it was working correctly. They sent me a replacement, but not the exact one now. This time they sent me a newer version. Has a little LED actually lit in there when it is off. And I had it on tonight for over an hour at half brilliance, and I'm satisfied. It didn't flicker at all, so it's rock solid right now. See, when I looked at the old switch, it had two black wires on it. One black wire, when I look really close now, one black wire stands alone. The other black wire goes into the switch right where the green ground wire goes in, which made me believe that maybe that would be the neutral and the standalone wire would be the one they want you to feed. But why in the world they put two black wires on a switch where they tell you connect to the black wire is unbelievable. I mean, they could have used white, they could have used red, they could have used purple, but so be it, that's the way it is. But anyway, all is well that ends well, and the situation seems to be resolved. So I'm going to, I guess, let sleeping dogs lie right now. W02N, thank you very much. It's interesting. By the way, I am running the candelabra bulb. I have 860 watters. It's a small chandelier. So it's about 480 watts rated with using a 600-watt rated dimmer switch. And it's working right now. Back to net, W02N. And thank you very much.
WB2HWW with a very important comment on this subject.
Howie recognized. We'll get to you in a minute. Bernie, do you still have the old switch, the one that's got the two black wires? And if so, will you be able to put your ohm meter between those two black wires and see if it's nearly 0 ohms? I think they might be wired to the exact same spot. Back to you, Bernie.
I did send back, but I do have one that was failing here also that was doing... Yeah, I can get that switch and check the ohms on it. Go ahead.
Yeah, when you do, I think you're going to find something close to zero. Howie, go right ahead with your comment.
And come back to me, Dick. I know what his problem is.
Roger. Go ahead, Howie.
If he's using a plastic 1900 box, that's a violation in New York City. It also might be in any national electrical code violation. You definitely want to mount those things in a metal box. A lot of people will use plastic boxes, but in New York City, you're not allowed to do that.
It's not that bad, Howie. Bernie lives in Maastricht, Long Island. And in Maastricht, Long Island, there's lots of homes here that are wired to code with those blue plastic boxes. My older house has got metal ones, so... But they're being sold in Home Depot and Lowe's and whatever. So in Suffolk County, I think the blue plastic breakout box is legal. That's my belief. We'll soon find out about that. Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Comment, it's not safe. It may not be the code, but it ain't safe.
Yeah, I agree. agree with you, it's less safe, though, although there is one slight improvement. On a number of occasions, I've opened up a metal breakout box, which had a double light switch in there, and if I wasn't real careful in the way I backed it out when I was taking it apart, if one of the leads on the side of the switch touched the metal box, I blew a fuse. With a blue plastic box, I wouldn't have that problem. I'll admit that the grounding integrity with a blue plastic box is nowhere near as good. But when it comes to working on it, there is a slight improvement in safety for the way a person typically does wiring, at least the way I did it. That's an opinion. Mel, K2KEY, K2RIW.
Okay, oh boy, I just saw a discharge of lightning, tremendous bolt right here. Unbelievable. Okay, anyhow, getting back to this, if you're going to put a, you know, switch in a metal box or an outlet in there, you can put a run of tape around it, you know, so that if you want to pull it out without tripping the breaker off, that's the easiest way to do, you know, just put one turn of tape around the terminal, you know, go around the receptacle, I always do that. But the point is, the candelabra bulb, they draw more current. A 60-watt candelabra bulb will fall more than a 60-watt regular round bulb, Dick. I found that out, that they use more electric, the candelabras. Now, also what happened was possibly the original one he put in, he may not have had that trouble initially. And over a period of time, he cooked that triac. He cooked that whole thing, and that's when he started to see the trouble. Now, this new one may be good for a while, but if he continues using it like that, there's a good chance he's going to have a repeat performance of what he had before. Over.
WW with another comment.
Howie recognized. Bear in mind now, the failed dimmer is the one that Bernie sent back to the factory, and they supposedly did a test on it. And in open air, not inside of a blue box, probably feeding a pure resistive 450-watt dummy load, it seemed to work okay. But he's now got a new one in there. Hopefully it's a better rated one. And he also knows that if he dwells for a long period of time with the light bulb at half brilliance, he is pushing the specification of that dimmer to its worst condition. And so I think the recommended procedure would be to either beef up what the manufacturer did, do something to create a better heat sink for the poor triac that's in there, maybe go to a metal box. But another recommendation would be go to the next higher rated unit. If he's using a 600-watt rated unit, and if they make a 1,000-watt rated unit, then going to the 1,000-watt for incandescent bulbs when it's mounted inside of a blue box might be the way to go. Let's see what Howie has to say on this. Go ahead, Howie. KQRIW.
Comment is not on the thing anymore. My comment is that when you start to remove an outlet or a switch, people shouldn't be lazy. You know, your life is at stake. Yeah, if you're an electrician doing it all day long, you know what you're doing. Yeah, you can leave the circuit breaker on, but I would open the circuit breaker. If you're going to do something, you know what? Don't always rely on a circuit breaker. But if that circuit breaker could fail, you can start a fire in your house. So my opinion, being around enough electricians, is pull the fuse, pull the line, and work on it over the years. That's just a safety thing. WD3, WW.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Whenever you work on anything electrical, remove the power first. Unplug the plug on your transmitter before you open up the case. Discharge the capacitors when you're working on household wiring. Pull the fuse for at least that section of the house, if not the whole house. Good sounding theory. Good practice if you can do it. Whenever my light bulbs fail, whenever a switch fails, it's in the dead of winter, 9 o'clock at night. The family's hollering that, hey, that circuit's not working. And if you pull the main circuit breaker for the house and you turn the whole house dark, it becomes a bit more difficult to do the work. Of course, with the right kind of flashlight, you can do it. But we've all pushed our luck a little bit. One of the things that I've done when it comes to household wiring is I'll wear a thick pair of leather gloves while I'm doing the work. At least my hands don't get electrocuted quite as easily. It's one possible improvement, or maybe rubber gloves would be a better way to do it. And most of the tools that you use, if you ground them by mistake, you'll blow a fuse, open a circuit breaker, most of the time. Howie's got a good point. If that circuit breaker does fail in the closed mode, when you've got a short circuit on that particular circuit, you can make smoke and flames in the house, and life will get complicated pretty fast. One of the things that should never, never be done is to use a circuit breaker as an on-off switch. We've all done it. You should never do it. Each circuit breaker has a specific number of times in which it is capable of opening full load without failing. Each time you open those contacts when it's under full load, you're doing a small amount of arcing. You're doing a small amount of pitting of those contacts. You can only do that a certain number of times. And if every day in the week you use the circuit breaker as an on-off switch, you are pushing the life of that circuit breaker. Eventually it's going to fail on you. And if it fails by welding itself shut, you don't have a circuit breaker anymore. So that's something else to remember. And if anybody with any further comments on this subject, give me a call. Let us right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Let me make another comment on this, because you're getting into a very interesting subject here where I used to work for.
How we recognize? Anyone else? You've got it, Howie.
First job out of Pratt, I worked for U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. Circuit breakers have another rating that people don't realize about. It's called ampere interrupted capacity. It's the maximum amount of current that a circuit breaker can take for four cycles. When you are figuring out, like, you want a 5,000 AIC or a 10,000 AIC circuit breaker, you want to figure out the impedance of the transformer to the box. And what you're trying to figure out is what happens if you have a dead short for a split second. What is the maximum current you're going to draw in that line? And it can be thousands of amps. You want to look at the impedance, not to the, to the power company, but to the transformer that you're coming off of. Because what can happen is you could have shorts for a split second or micro shorts and people and circuit breakers have been known to explode. Go ahead, Dick.
Yeah, another very good point. A dead short, every circuit breaker is going to take some number of milliseconds to open. So therefore, it must sustain thousands of amperes for some period of time when you put a dead short across it. Hopefully, a circuit breaker is being used where the load is more friendly. If the circuit breaker is good for 15 amperes, and if your load slowly climbs from 12 to 13 to 14 to 15 to 16 amperes, and it opens, that's one condition. But if you've created a dead short circuit, and that circuit is drawing 1,000 amperes instead of 15, when those contacts have to open, obviously they're going to behave very differently. The arcing of those contacts will be very different. I got into a similar situation in a couple of discussions we had on the microwave reflector, the WA1 MBA reflector, in which a couple of guys in Europe were running into a problem where they were getting power supply failures. They had bought themselves very low impedance hypersill power transformers, good for a 1500 watt moon bounce rig. And when they threw the switch for the primary circuit on a 220 volt or 240 volt wiring in their house in Scandinavia, as I remember, and there was no startup resistor in a capacitor input filter network 2 kilovolt power supply, or maybe it was a 3500 volt power supply, that primary impedance on that transformer was probably in the milliohms, depending on the resistance of the wiring of their house, the instantaneous current that flows when you throw that switch. I proved to those guys with a couple of mathematical scenarios that the current can be extremely high because you cannot charge a capacitor instantaneously. By definition, you cannot instantaneously change the voltage on a capacitor. So if your PI output filter network of your bridge rectifier fed, transformer fed power supply, if that input capacitor has a small enough internal series resistance, equivalent series resistance, and it's a big enough beefy capacitor, it represents a dead short circuit. And your Your bridge rectifiers are being hit with a lot of current. Your transformer is being hit with a lot of current. The household circuit is being hit with a lot of current. And I think the problem they were running into is they couldn't find a slow enough reacting circuit breaker.
Repeater, timeout.
They weren't able to find a circuit breaker for the house that had a slow enough reaction time that it would start up that power supply without tripping. The right answer, of course, is to put a starting resistor. In other words, in the power supply, somewhere in the primary or the secondary circuit, you plug in a resistor, which limits the inrush current, and then a time delay relay shorts out that resistor so you get full efficiency out of the power supply. That's one approach. Not an ideal approach, because a child who comes along and decides to have some fun with your on-off switch of your power supply and sits there and flips it on and off cyclically, it can do a lot of damage. It can heat up a lot of components. So inrush current on capacitor input power supplies is something to worry about. If you're starting up a whole room full of computers because you run a facility that does word processing, and many of those power supplies are very simple direct line rectifiers into a capacitor, and they have a ridiculously high starting current. There's quite a few things like that where people don't consider it until they start running into problems with circuit breakers. Okay, the next person who signed in was Bill, KC2TUX, I think it was, Bill. Go right ahead, Bill, with your problem. KC2TUX, if I got the call letters right. K2RIW on the TechNet.
Dick, get back to me about circuit breakers and tell your story.
Okay, we'll pick up Bill first, and then we'll come back to that one. Go ahead, Bill.
Hey, Dick, how are you? Yeah, you got the call sign correct. KC2 Tango Uniform X-Ray. I had heard you a few months back talking about something far away from the amateur radio, and I saw some information on this, and I figured I'd give you the question, because I can't find anything definite about it. One website that I found this on, and obviously I don't feel that because it's on the web it must be true. But what this website is claiming is that adding acetone to fuel increases your fuel mileage. Very small amounts, like one part for 5,000 or one part for 3,000, depending on the vehicle. It claims that it aids in the vaporization of the gas or diesel, increasing efficiency, engine longevity and performance, and reducing hydrocarbons. So I don't know how much of this is true, but I can't seem to find anybody that's done any research on it.
Okay, you're adding something to fuel. I'm not sure now if you're talking about gasoline for an automobile, or fuel oil for a home heating system, or fuel oil for a diesel system. You're adding some kind of an additive. You used a word that I didn't recognize, so spell that word out for us, Bill. Go ahead.
Talking about automotive engines, both gasoline and diesel, adding acetone, A-C-E-T-O-N-E. Acetone is a common hardware store liquid for cleaning your paintbrushes or something along those lines, and it claims that it aids in, it's actually nail polish remover also. Thank you to TXS behind me throwing in comments.
Where did you first find out about adding acetone, A-C-E-T-O-N-E? Now I hear you. Where did you hear the theory that that makes an improvement? Was it an article written in a respected magazine somewhere? Was it an urban legend on a website? Where did you first come in contact with the concept, Bill? Go ahead.
Definitely not in a peer-reviewed magazine or anything like that. I was just surfing the web looking for fuel-efficient vehicles and this and that and the other thing, and I just stumbled upon the website. And it's only one website that I can find that has any information on it. A couple of websites where anybody can post anything to have comments about it, but obviously, if it's on the web, doesn't mean it's true. So I just found it while surfing.
Okay. And what is the claim of improvement, Bill? Are they saying you get a 5% improvement in gas mileage? Something like that? Do they Did they quantify it or just say it's going to get a whole lot better? Over to you, Bill.
There was one website that somebody had written some information about claiming exactly how their mileage was increased, but it was claims that it aids in it decreases the surface tension of gasoline or diesel to help it vaporize better while going through the carburetor.
Interesting. I'm going to throw it open to the net and see if anyone else has any information on adding acetone to your automobile fuel system in order to improve gas mileage, carburetor cleanliness, vaporization characteristics, whatever. As you can tell, I'm a little bit skeptical. I don't think that the improvement is going to be huge. Is it real? I would say it's impossible. What you want that fuel to do in the carburetor and or fuel injectors is to become atomized to the smallest possible sizes of the particles. In most cases, I think you want that. The so-called additives you add that used to be lead to our fuel really control the flame front velocity. In other words, each time the spark plug fires, there is an explosion that happens in that cylinder, and the rate at which the flame front propagates across that top of the piston inside of that cylinder, there's an ideal rate at which you want that flame to propagate so that you don't get knocking condition. You don't want it to all light up at once. You want you'd like to have the compressed fuel mixture burn and expand in a controlled manner as the piston is moved down, and if it did that, you'd get the highest efficiency out of the engine. So lead as an additive obviously was done in order to control this flame velocity, in order to stop the knocking, in order to make a high compression automobile work better. So obviously additives do something good. Can simple acetone do that is a darn interesting question. Let's see if anyone has any information on this one. I don't. Anybody know about acetone or anything else you can add to the fuel of an automobile to make any kind of improvement in performance? Give us your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY.
That guy, Mel. Boy, those guys on Dover Street, they know a little bit of everything. Go right ahead, Mel. I'm off of your subject.
Okay, yeah, I watched the program on they had on the Science Channel about cars, you know, futuristic cars and all that stuff, and cars that they're designing to run on ethanol, you know, engines that'll run pure ethanol. Right now, I think it's about 10% ethanol and all, but they have engines right now that are on the drawing board. I guess they're out there that'll run on at least 85% ethanol. Now, the ethanol does something similar. It spreads out the burning. Gasoline usually sometimes explodes and peaks off before it's spread out. So in other words, that you're losing more up the tailpipe. The average automobile, used to throw out, waste 75% of the gasoline, literally, and all kinds of stuff going out the tail. So they came up with a number of ideas, mixtures, so-called, that reduces this tendency for the gasoline to, you know, quickly explode and be pushed out the tailpipe by spreading it out over a longer period, take a smoother or a more, letting it expand more, if you know what I'm talking about. But I wanted to make a comment about the circuit breaker also. But all right, let's leave it at this right now. Over.
Yeah, there's an ideal rate at which the flame of a spark plug, a flame initiated by a spark plug, should propagate across the fuel mixture during that so-called power stroke. You'd like the expansion to take place in a way that's compatible with the piston moving down, and you'll get the greatest efficiency out of a so-called Carnot cycle, which is the way an internal combustion engine works. So, can acetone do that? It looks like this particular gathered group of people doesn't know, as I see it, Bill. And by the way, Bill, you live in Farmingdale. I used to live in South Farmingdale way back in the dark ages on Yoakum Avenue for a whole lot of time. That was way back in
the late 40s, way before your time. I used to call Farmingdale my hometown, so you live in a good place. Got some friends and relatives that are still living there. Looks like we got to dig a little bit deeper on acetone now, Bill. I don't think we got an answer. And you've stumped this particular gathering of people. Your name will go on the great big list that Mel is assembling of the people that we're going to hold a drawing. You've stumped the TechNet. Therefore, your name goes into a drawing. And if your name is pulled out, you and your lady friend will be entertained in a very expensive restaurant. That's the claim. I will admit that it hasn't, that prize hasn't been issued very often so far, Bill. KC2TUX. Good question. We don't have an answer. K2LAW.
2A, K2TUX. I'm going to continue looking for information on this. Obviously, you know, if it's something that's really that fantastic, it should have been, you know, world known. And what Mel was talking about is E85 fuel. I think that's derived from organic, like corn, and it's expensive to manufacture. So E85 is something that's around. But I think other countries, if I'm not mistaken, Brazil has been using E85 for a while. But the cost to manufacture it is prohibitive for the labor rates that we produce here in the United States, so to speak. Well, if I find any further information, I'll try and look up your email address online. I'm sure I can send you an email somewhere, and I'll send you any information through email, and maybe you can delve further into it. Thank you very much for your time and patience, and I'm cheap. I'll eat at a pizza place, so no problem. Yeah, I live in Farmingdale right near the Farmingdale train station, getting ready to move, though. KC2TUX. Thank you, Dick.
Yes, I remember the train station is in extreme northern Farmingdale, not too far from the Bethpage Golf Course, which is right around the corner from there. And I lived in south Farmingdale, so you and I lived in the same town, but pretty far apart. And I was there for quite a few years. Was there someone else who wanted to sign in with reference to acetone or any other additives to fuel for an automobile? And Bill, when you do find an answer, you don't have to send it to me by email. You can come back to the net. We amateur radio operators are people interested in all kinds of scientific things. And although this is a little bit off to one side, we're not that rushed on the tech net. We do take some subjects that I would call this a green subject. In other words, if the report was accurate, then the acetone added to the fuel would make the fuel more green, and the TechNet people like to be green. So you're in the right area. My call letters are in QRZ.com, and there's an email address there. You can also use my call letters at ARRL.net. There's lots of ways of getting things to me. Was there someone else who wanted to give us an opinion on fuel additives? I thought I heard somebody break in. K2RIW in the TechNet listening.
And to QMU.
WO2N from the East Link.
Okay, we got WO2N and N2. You said it clearly, but I didn't catch it. The N2 station, go first. Go ahead. Give us your name.
Bill, N2QMU. Acetone, I guess, is similar to isopropyl alcohol and ethyl alcohol. Isopropyl alcohol, I think, is used, it's maybe called as dry gas. I think that they all burn similarly, although I'm not sure if acetone has the same qualities as the alcohols do, because the alcohols allow water to mix with the gas, and that helps in a different way.
Okay, so I think you're saying, Bill, into Quebec Mike Uniform, if I got your call letters correct, Beth Page, that it is a kind of an alcohol-like substance. Therefore, I think you're saying it may burn like alcohol. And I do know that the energy content of alcohol-bearing fuels is definitely lower than the energy content of normal petroleum fuels, oil-based fuels. And whenever I use a fuel that's got a higher alcohol content, I notice that my automobile gets less miles per gallon. Also, the additives that we use down here on Long Island are doing things to our fuel that are very different than the fuels that are used upstate. There was a 4-year period of time in which every weekend I was traveling back and forth between Utica, New York, working at the Romare Development Center, and Long Island, and a tank full of fuel that I would pick up in Utica would drive me all the way home and then 3 more days around the around Long Island. Whereas the fuel that I bought on Long Island, I could barely get to Utica with it without refueling. So there was a huge difference as I saw it. And I worry that the alcohol-bearing fuels, not only they, because of our labor rates, expensive to produce, and it eats into the fuel, it eats into the food that we should be using as opposed to making it into fuel, but the fact that it gives less mileage is not a happy circumstance that I seem to be observing. I wonder if you've seen something similar to that one, Bill. Into QMU, K2RYW.
No additional information other than the similarity between ethanol, isopropyl ethanol, and acetone.
Okay, thank you for that information, Bill. W-O-2-N. I should know you. Tell me your name and your comment.
Okay, Dick. Now, what Mel was referring to is really like, he's talking about like high test gasoline, where gasoline is rated in octane. And if acetone could increase the octane, you would get a slower burning, which would give you a better gas mileage. And also help with the way sometimes, well, the engines with diesel and all, it's better under heat conditions. It doesn't ignite as quickly. So in higher temperatures, it may act better. But if you increase the octane, I guess you increase the performance of the vehicle and probably better MPH, in my opinion. So gasoline rated in octane, when you talk about gas, and diesel fuel would be rated in cellophane. So that's a different, you know, test equipment and whatnot with diesel. But getting back to gas, increasing the burning, the rate of burning would help give you better mileage, in my opinion. And that is where the difference between octane ratings come in. The higher the octane, the slower the burning. W-O-2-N.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bernie. The higher the octane, the slower the burn, the slower the flame front, flame velocity. If you took a low compression ratio modern-day automobile that was designed for a low-octane fuel, and you give it a high-octane fuel, you get almost no or very little increase in mileage. The higher-octane fuels were intended for higher-compression vehicles. If you got a vehicle with a 12.5-to-1 compression ratio instead of an 8-to-1, these may be the numbers, I'm not sure, you would get knocking with low-octane fuel, and the higher-octane fuel would give you greater efficiency and less knock. But there are people who think they're really being kind to their car to put in high-tech gas if the car is designed for low-octane fuel. And that may not be true. It may not make an improvement. That's what I've heard, but I'm not sure about that one. And with any further comments, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
I wanted to make another comment about circuit breakers, Dick.
Yeah, go ahead and tell us about circuit breakers, Mel.
Okay, you were mentioning about the welding of the contacts together. It still does not ruin the circuit breakers to the point where, at that point where you say the circuit breaker is not going to open. They got a link inside the circuit breaker because I had spoken to a guy one time that works for Federal Pacific as a company that makes circuit breakers. And we were talking about, you know, conditions that circuit breakers, why they fail and all that stuff. And I said, well, what happens if the contacts get to a point where they will weld and you get a heavy short? What will happen? He says they're all designed as part of the circuit breaker technology at Underwriters Laboratory. Okay, is a couple of amperes above its rating. In other words, let's say a 20 ampere circuit breaker will trip somewhere around 20 amps. If the contacts welded in there, and you went up, say, to like 30 amps or so, the backup link in there will open. Of course, that's the end of the circuit breaker. Of course, there's most likely it's no good anyhow, but that's what they have in there, a safety link inside there connected to the contact. Over.
Glad to hear that. And I'm not convinced that it's always there. And here's what makes me say that. I was working on the B-1B bomber program, Airborne Instruments Laboratory, roughly 1990, and there was a particular three-phase 400-cycle circuit that was running a particular bench where transmitters were being tested. I think it was a 240-volt three-phase circuit, and somebody did something wrong where a screwdriver was put across two of those phases, and a tremendous amount of current was drawn. The end of the screwdriver vaporized. The heat that was created by that short circuit with that screwdriver in that person's hand, it had a plastic handle, so his hand wasn't injured, but the heat that was generated singed his eyebrows and the hair on the front of his forehead and whatever, created minor facial damage, no eye damage. He was lucky. I think he had his eyes closed at the time. So it melted and vaporized the end of the screwdriver, created all of this damage to the person who was nearby, and that particular 30-ampere circuit breaker did not trip. So maybe it was an extremely brief event. Maybe it's something unique about a 400-cycle circuit. I'm not quite sure what all was going on. But here is a, it may be a 20-amp circuit, but I think it was a 30-amp circuit, but the circuit did not break, did not open up under what looked like a dead short that vaporized the end of a screwdriver, a rather hefty screwdriver, by the way, and the steel was just gone, as I said, vaporized. So look out for these high current, relatively high voltage circuits. 240, I guess, is considered high. Much of Europe runs on 240 volts, where we use 120, and they also like 50 hertz instead of 60 hertz. When you look at the appropriate chapter of the reference data for radio engineers, and you look at the kind of main power that's used for private homes and factories, but mostly private homes in various countries, the voltages and the frequencies are kind of amazing how different they are in various places. Japan, in fact, I think has some of their country running on 50 hertz and some of it running on 60 hertz.
So even with a repeater, time out.
So even within the same country, power can be significantly different. I think there are portions of South America like that also. Power is interesting stuff. I wonder if Eric is available, KE2EJ. If so, I've got a couple of questions for him. Eric, are you online tonight? K2RAW in the TechNet.
K2RAW, KE2EJ.
Okay, we're not going to get into it immediately because we've got... Joe, RYY, waiting. I gave him a promise that we're going to give him a much better answer. We gave him a... I and you and everyone else gave him an improper answer last week. I went and listened to the tape, and I was kind of embarrassed of some of the things that we said to poor Joe last week. We know something about what he's going to do, but the latest issue of Electronic Design News, EDN it's called, and this is the issue that just arrived at my mailbox, even though it's dated May 14th. The May 14th issue has a very nice article entitled Into Thin Air, The ATSC Reception Isn't Always Easy. It describes what this poor engineer went through who lives in Colorado when he wanted the local digital television reception. And he had to go through an awful lot of procedure to get good digital television reception, even though he was only 20 miles from two or three different broadcast stations. My main question to you is going to be... since we are only 2.5 or 3 weeks away from the deadline in which we're all going to lose analog television or have to go over to digital television, and some of us, like me, are kind of cheap and we're going to go out and buy a digital television converter, and it suddenly struck me that, gee, I haven't decided which brand I'm going to buy. Let me drop. One of the guys I work with has bought four different digital converters to add in front of his analog television set. He was very displeased with three of them. I think he bought some of them from places like Sears Roebuck or whatever. I'm not quite sure where he bought them, but he bought three different ones that he was unhappy with, and he sold them on eBay. Finally, he settled on the one that's being sold by Radio Shack. He gave me the model number, Data Stream or something like that was the name of the thing. And he says, boy, is that sensitive, and boy, does that tolerate multipath and figure out what's going on and give him pictures and a whole lot of places where the previous converters did not. So my question to you is, what's the model number, and where is it sold, how many dollars is a digital converter that you recommend? Now, I know that this is a little bit of a problem, because you're not in the business of recommending particular brand names, model numbers, and the fifth generation, and whatever, but is there a model number that you know of that works well, that's easy for us to get? Is it sold by Radio Shack? Questions along those lines. If you're willing to stick your neck out, and you don't have to, KE2EJ, K2RIW on the tech net.
K2RIW, KE2EJ. Well, I'm very happy with the Digital Stream box, which is the same as the Zenith box, which is the same as an LG box, because they're all made by LG. They have fifth generation equalizers in them, and that's why they work so nice. You would figure that LG would have the fifth generation equalizers in it, because they manufacture the chips for everyone else, so they're going to have it faster than the other people. So that's why. And by the way, I have that edition of EDM sitting on my desk at work, so I haven't actually had a chance to look at it, but now I have an interest to go look at it faster. The Digital Stream box sold by Radio Shack, if you get the coupon, depending upon whether they're running their sale, when I bought mine, they were running their sales. They only cost $15 a piece, but without the sale, I think they're $20 or $40, I forget. But that's an excellent box. And if you want to go into the reasons why, then we can do that, but I think we've done that before. K2IWK, here we go.
Fantastic. Okay, you backed up what this guy I work with said. He's very happy with the something stream, I know it was, Digital Stream, Radio Shack, and it's a fifth generation box, which, and the majority of those generations are the ability for it to do the equalization, in other words, to tolerate multipath signals that have inter-symbol distortion, and it manages to figure it all out. I presume it's doing something like a transversal filter. In other words, it's a an infinite impulse response filter. It's the way in the old days a filter like that used to be generated before there were digital techniques, is you would have the equivalent of a shift register, which has a whole bunch of taps on it, and those various taps were fed back to a summing circuit with various amplitudes and polarities. And when you do that just right, you can either cancel or add in the multipath signal and just right, so that you get more power output with less distortion. And I presume it's now being done by fancy digital techniques, but is it a quasi-transversal filter that is doing this equalization of the fifth generation converter? KE2EJ, K2RIW.
K2RIW, K2J. Okay, it's really, you can think of it as not an IIR filter, but a FIR filter in terms of its layout. Actually, it's a combination of filters. It has one which is called a direct feed-forward equalizer, which actually takes and looks at its sample over a period of time and changes its coefficients. Then there's also it'll come to me. One deals with making the decision of what's a pre-ghost and what's a ghost. And the other one makes the decision about where the most signal is. So it's actually the DFE, or the direct feed forward equalizer, that does most of the work. The acronym's not coming to me. You're going to have to wait for that. That device looks for the pre-ghost, then creates a bias that actually changes the coefficients in the FIR filter that comes afterwards. And the interesting thing about the way the equalizer is set up is that because it is a multiply tap device, it can, because it's basically doing an arithmetic function, it's basically adding multiplying and adding again, and by doing that, the way the fur filter is laid out, if you look at it in terms of a machine state, it will